Good evening from Northern California. We are back with The Lady in Gold, the extraordinary tale of Gustav Klimt's masterpiece, Portrait of Adele Bloch-Bauer, written by Anne Marie O'Connor. We are at Art History on page 276. In Vienna, the impact of the Bloch-Bauer restitution rippled out of ministries and courtrooms and into cafes and dinner parties. Austrian officials were forced to confront the fact that the world saw the restitution cases differently, and they had paid a price for this. They might pay even more. Long-lost heirs with illustrious family names were submitting new claims for paintings stolen during the war. One of the clouds on Austria's horizon was Baroness Marianne Kirstin Jacobs, an elegant, willowy older woman who was an heir to the letter collection. The Baroness was trying to recover Klimt's portrait of Ria Munk, which had been commissioned by Ria's mother, Aranka Munk, the Baroness's great aunt. The portrait had disappeared from Aranka's sacked villa, or via, at Bad Aussee. At that moment, the painting was at the Landesmuseum in Linz. When the Nazis came, the museums helped themselves, like self-service at Walmart, the Baroness said angrily. The Baroness took a seat on a buttery yellow leather sofa in front of a letterer collection of cast bronze statues of Bacchus, the lusty god of wine and pleasure, dating from the 1600s. She opened a box of photographs of Gustav Uccicchi, presented in a Nazi court to argue that Elisabeth Bachofenecht, her great-aunt, was his half-sister. She lifted up Elisabeth's typewritten memoir. She wrote how he took her on his knee like a father. I'm sure he did, but it had nothing to do with that. She wrote it to save her life. She succeeded, but she didn't live very long after that, the Baroness said, raising her eyebrows meaningfully. Her brother Eric was a good friend of the Bachofens, but they tried to take everything that belonged to Elisabeth, even after Wolfgang divorced her. There was a long lawsuit after the war. The Baroness was not convinced that the entire letterer Klimt collection had been destroyed. The Belvedere took many paintings away from Schloss Immendorf before it was burned, the Baroness said. Are some of them sitting in someone's castle right now, somewhere in Austria? After the war, Eric Lederer, Elizabeth's brother, went back to Austria, but Austria held on to his family's property. Officials neglected the Lederer mansion until it caved in. Eric found the Klimt Beethoven frieze in a dank monastery, surrounded by rubble. My uncle Eric took the photographs to the Belvedere and said, "Are you completely crazy? It's sitting in water," she said. He couldn't take it out of the country, so finally he sold it to Belvedere. If they loved Klimt so much, would they do this? They just want to hang on to everything. I hope that the background noise isn't coming through on my recording. Just realized my window's wide open here. Let me pause for a sec. There we go. I hope this is better. The Baroness was born in 1943 into the Protestant family of Eric's wife, Baroness Elisabeth von Jacobs. Eric had hid art above her family ceiling when he fled. After the war, the childless Eric paid to fix their bombed-out roof and sent the Baroness to a French lessee. When he died, she inherited his restitution claims. The Baroness pulled out a letter from Felix Herz, a post-war culture minister. "Look," he says, "we would love to give you back your art, but if we give it to you, we have to give all the art back to everyone," the Baroness said. Does anyone really believe Adele would have given her paintings to these people if she had lived through the war? The Baroness said irately. They returned Adele only because they had to. The whole world was watching the case. Don't you think if they really regretted everything that happened with the Nazis, they would stop finding excuses not to return people's paintings? The senior legal counsel for the Austrian state, Gottfried Thoman, clung to his conviction that Adele's wishes had been violated. She wanted a monument to herself in Austria. Now she's hanging in a museum in New York. I seriously doubt it was with the intention of Adele Blockbauer for her paintings to be spread all over the world, Thoman said on a warm golden afternoon in October under the arched spires of the Café Central. His cheeks were pink from the sun, contrasting with his navy blue barrister's suit, set off by a gold silk tie and a tiny gold pinky ring. He had a deferential, courtly demeanor. Adele was an extraordinary person in her lifetime, Thoman mused, sipping his cappuccino. You know, if you compare the portraits of Adele, it is quite fascinating. The first portrait is very erotic, full of love and understanding. The second one is a pale, ghostly face with tobacco-stained teeth. I think it is quite clear that at the time of the second painting, the affair was definitely over, Thoman said, and Thoman, too, had succumbed to the cult of Adele. I think Maria was Randall's greatest asset, he said. I'm not sure he would have won without her. She had a certain elegance, a sense of humor, a way of speaking German that people remember hearing when they were children. Thoman still believed that someday a document or letter would surface to prove that he was right, that the paintings belonged to Austria. The only problem we had with this cause is, or with this case, is we never found the so-called smoking gun. We both had no hard evidence, Thoman said. He was so totally convinced that he was the one, the only one who knew what justice was. I've never met someone so absolutely convinced he was right. It was more of a crusade than a legal battle. And of course, from a financial standpoint, it was the case of a lifetime, Thoman added dryly. I had no Maria, Thoman sighed. I had the burden of history. This was extraordinary. The position of Maria Altman fleeing the Nazis was, of course, terrible, but it was not relevant from a strictly legal point of view. This is a case based on a will of 1923. This has nothing to do with the Holocaust. Of course, it was easier to argue this case behind the windshield of the terrible events of the Holocaust. The fact that the chairman of the panel was German-born affected his decision-making enormously, Thoman said. If an Austrian had been sitting in the driver's seat, it would have been different, he said. Many Austrians have personal guilt, but it's not like the collective guilt that Germans share. This was not a legal decision, Thoman mused. It was a referendum on the events of World War II, and even that era was not so black and white, Thoman said, repeating an Austrian refrain that was by now familiar. Thoman's own father had faced a simple choice, to be in the German army or to be unemployed. His uncle had joined too. Personally, Personally, I have the feeling that Austria felt the Nazi approach was a new approach for a new time, Thoman said. They didn't know the evil of this regime, or they didn't want to see it. After World War I, they had lost their world. And here comes this guy who says, I will show you a new dawn. Of course he said some ugly things about the Jews, but people didn't know it would lead to the Holocaust. Many, many people were involved with this regime and thought it would be an advantage to the economy and then realized in wartime what it meant. Personally, I'm glad I didn't live in this time. I don't know which way my life would have gone. Standing in line, unemployed with my kids, I don't know what I would have done. Do you know 15 or 16-year-old boys were pressed into the SS? Not everyone who was in the Waffen-SS has personal guilt. Is every one of those 15 or 16-year-old boys guilty? Were they really able to make that choice, or their choice? It is sometimes easy to make decisions after World War II. I don't know what my personal fate would have been. Who knows? Who could have guessed the history of Vienna would be told by its paintings? Adele was no longer a beautiful enigma. Vienna, too, was being stripped of mystery as Adele and Klimt's other stolen women changed the city's relationship with its past. Each stolen painting had a story, and each story raised pressing moral questions. Regardless of whether one believed the Blockbauer Klimts should be returned, it was impossible to look at the paintings the same way again. It had been possible to avoid history, but not the talismanic images of these blameless, insulted daughters of Vienna. The restitutions gave the paintings a potent, unspoken psychological dimension, like the dream symbols of Freud. It stirs up a lot of things for the old people, things they don't want to deal with, observed Felicitas Kunt, the new provenance director of the Dorotheum. There's too much personal guilt. Artistic provenance was no longer just an investigation into the authenticity of Vienna's artistic treasures. It was a rediscovery of its past. One expert, Sophie Lilly, wrote a Bible-sized catalog of stolen art for Cezerny's Library of Theft called What Once Was. It revealed a ghost town in Vienna of lost families, lost salons, lost love affairs, lost paintings, and lost lives. The high-profile restitutions led to other questions such as, what did my grandfather do during the war? One Belvedere provenance researcher discovered that his father had attended an elite Nazi military academy and his grandfather had commanded a slave labor camp where he shot a man. My oldest friend was from the hardcore Nazi family, Lily said over goulash at an outdoor table at the Café Korb. It really pained him. He didn't know for certain, she said. Then a magazine published a list of high-ranking Nazis, and his grandfather was one of them. He said, Sophie, you're in the archives a lot. Can you pick up his file? Almost everybody had Nazis in their family here. It's your father and grandfather, people you love and want to protect. All those people had a past. The provenance cases shed light on other mysteries, mysteries familiar to the Viennese. Ruth Player, a researcher on the Blockbauer case, played as a child at a neighbor's house that was filled with books that none of them read and paintings they knew nothing about. Eventually, Player learned the entire house had been Aryanized. The family lived there like extras on a film set. You grew up not knowing, Player said. Now people are finding out. In Vienna's complex recent past, everyone in Vienna is related to persecutors or the persecuted. Player said, in some cases, they are related to both. This mixed inheritance was the uneasy birthright of Stanislaus Bachofen Echt, a hip young heir with the fine good looks and antiquated air of a romantic poet. His apartment on Graf Strahomberg Gasse was a museum of alabaster vases and dynastic oil paintings. On his mantle was the coat of arms of the Bachofenex, who were made barons in 1906. Like many Viennese, they continued to use the title after titles were abolished in 1919. Just back from India, Stanislaus poured jasmine tea and explained how this Viennese desire to be on the inside track might have been among the reasons his father, Werner, joined Austria's illegal Nazi party in 1933. He realized he could do good business, Stanislaus said, among the well-connected fraternity in his small party. His father's brother, Eberhard, was a real Nazi and joined the SS. My family always said Eberhard joined the SS because he looked handsome in the uniform, Stanislaus said, looking skeptical. His father's other brother, Wolfgang, joined the Austrian Nazi Party with them in 1933, but his flirtation was more complicated. Wolfgang was the husband of Elisabeth Bachofenecht. Like the rest of his generation, Stanislaus was left to puzzle through this era and his family's role in it. Stanislaus had heard the family legend of the marriage since he was a child. During the downturn in the family fortunes, the Bakofen-Echt brothers had convened a card game at the Hotel Sacher to decide which of them would propose to the conspicuously eligible Elizabeth Lederer. The punchline was that no one knew whether Wolfgang had won or lost. The stories Stanislaus was told cast the Bakofen-Echt brothers in a typically benign light. Wolfgang divorced Elizabeth and took control of her property to protect her interests from seizure. Wolfgang took Elizabeth to join her mother in Budapest. Elizabeth was allowed to stay with Wolfgang in the Neusdorf great house of Eberhard. Eberhard sent SS officers to guard Elizabeth as Joachim Gass. During the war, two SS people were stationed in front of the Joachim Gass Palais so she wouldn't be arrested. Uncle Eberhard arranged this, Stanislaus said. I don't know how badly Wolfgang behaved, but I know Uncle Eberhard helped stationing SS outside the Palais. At least, that was the story. On the other hand, my grandfather said when he saw Eberhard, he would hide because Eberhard was dangerous, Stanislaus said. Eberhard was arrested after the war. I never found out why. As far as I know, he was not involved in the killings, Stanislaus said. There is a place in the state archive to find out. Someday I will. A yellowing U.S. military form in the archive said Eberhard was released in 1946 with a disability, psychosis. The apartment was crowded with enormous portraits of illustrious ancestors in heavy gilt frames and photographs, many of the late Hubertus Cernan. That's my cousin Hubertus, Stanislaus said. His mother and my mother were sisters. Our grandfather, Franz Josef Meyer Gunthoff, was part Jewish, and he was active in another fascist organization, the Heimwehr. He got a Nazi medal during the war for factory production, but then he had to give it back because he found out he was Jewish, Stanislaus laughed. It took a moment to adjust to the news that Cernan was closely related to Elizabeth Bakofen-Echt. Hubertus had mentioned some Bakofen-Echts in the family, calling them pure SS, and saying Elizabeth's marriage to a Bakofen-Echt was like a bad joke. Our other cousins were Jewish Shea barons who built the Shea Palace on the Ringstrasse, Stanislaus was saying. Our Shea cousins stayed for a long time after the Anschluss. Finally, my grandfather, Mayor Gunthoff, went to them and said, "You have to leave now." They couldn't believe they had to go. Hubertus's father was a Nazi too, Stanislaus said matter-of-factly. Hubertus had mentioned that his father had been a Nazi sympathizer, but said he was jailed at the end of the war for belonging to the resistance. I'm positive of it, Stanislaus continued. Hubertus was completely aware of it. Did you ever ask him? A few days later, Hubertus's older brother, Franz Joseph, slid into a red leather booth at the Café Bronnerhof in faded black jeans, horn-rimmed glasses, and a tattered green tweed blazer. He looked a bit like Elvis Costello. Franz Joseph was a poet. Little like Hubertus, he didn't mind staring history in the face. We had some Nazis in the family, Franz Joseph said, under the now familiar gaze of Thomas Bernhard, the theatrical conscience of Austria. Some family members had Jewish ancestors, and they would have liked to have been Nazis, but they weren't allowed to be Nazis because they were Jewish, Franz Joseph said. And our father? They said in 1935 he left the Nazis, but I don't think so. This was a myth. He worked in a German bank that occupied Belgium during the war, a bank that was involved in Aryanization. I believe they were involved in art Aryanization. Growing up, he explained, the story was he didn't become a Nazi or was was for a short time and then left the party. But then I found out my father was a Nazi party member in a good standing on a research database. A study came out on the Aryanization of Jewish banks. My father was working for a bank that did that, and his name came up as someone involved. Hubertus was curious. Franz Joseph took a sip of his espresso. "Most people were not heroes," he said. "My father was very kind. It doesn't take anything away. My mother's father, Franz Joseph Mayer Guntoff, a leader of the Heimwehr, was half Jewish, he said. He was sent to Mauthausen for 2 years, but not for being Jewish. It was because he made an anti-Nazi joke in his salon. A woman told the Gestapo. He was sentenced to death for treason. Then, at the end of the war, he was sent to Vienna and freed. My father told me at the end he was in the resistance. A lot of people said that. He said he spent the last weeks of the war jailed by the Nazis, and when the jail was bombed, he escaped. Who knows? Franz Joseph shrugged. In any case, I believe in collective guilt, Franz Joseph said. There must have been a sort of consensus, so they all have some guilt. If someone actually kills, they have more guilt. There are different levels, but it's a shared guilt. Someone might not have been a murderer, but they mingled with murderers. People say an SS officer was lucky he never killed someone. What difference does it make? He was part of it. I was almost 16 when our father died. Hubertus was only 11. Hubertus started to realize on his own how many lies were under the layers of secrecy. Hubertus discovered the whole psychology of Austrian amnesia. At the height of the Waldheim affair, some of their relatives stopped speaking to Hubertus. They said, "One doesn't do that to one's president. One lets the past rest in peace," Franz Joseph said. Adele was a symbol of Austria, too. When Austria lost Adele, a lot of people were sad and shocked. "Our paintings, leaving Austria," they were saying goodbye to Adele and to another illusion. "Paintings are not as important as a president," Franz Joseph said, but Hubertus saw in Adele the same layers of half-truths, lies, and amnesia he grew up with, even in his own family. There turned out to be plenty of information implicating their banker father, Count Felix Zernin, documents of the American Office of Military Government for Germany called Count Zernin a German espionage agent. The file said Zernin, alias Berger, agent number A306, joined the German Nazi Party in 1939. He was said to be deeply involved in the Aryanization of Jewish property and to have reported on his progress to a top Aryanizer for Reichsmarshal Hermann Göring. In 1945, in the dregs of the war, Felix was reportedly arrested for treason somewhere, but managed to escape. Another Zernin, Count, was an adjutant to Odilo Globuchnik, the butcher of Lublin, and did something to deserve Himmler's SS death's head ring. There were also whispers in the family about another relative, the late Igor Caruso. Caruso, an Italian aristocrat, came to Vienna to work at the pediatric clinic of the Steinhoff Hospital in 1942, when it was an infamous Nazi euthanasia center. Caruso had said he was horrified when he discovered this and quit to work for Prince Alfred Auersperg, a neurologist and SS man. Caruso died in 1981, but new Nazi-era archives were emerging on his boss, the unpunished Heinrich Gross, who still had a flat at the hospital as late as 1996. the last preserved brains of euthanized children were finally buried in 2002 after scores of children's remains were discovered in the clinic's cellar and laboratories. The press would report that Igor Caruso had personally evaluated 14 children who were later euthanized. One magazine headline would call Caruso a perpetrator who called himself a victim. For Hubertus, the search for his country's conscience began at home. Wow. Some of this is heavy duty. The once impenetrable Belvedere had itself become a center of intrigue. Its director, Gerbert Frodel, was now linked to Austria's failed effort to keep the Blockbauer Klimts. Behind his back, Belvedere's staff sniped that the museum archives contained a photograph of Frodel's father giving the Heil salute from the back of an open truck filled with stolen art. Frodel was born in 1940 and so was only a toddler when his father became one of Hitler's art collectors. It was a dark inheritance indeed. The Belvedere's secrets were spilling out. Staff whispered that the museum's bunker had been a last resort for Hitler in its construction ordered by the Nazi foreign minister Joachim von Ribbentrop. One curator said it had been a vast underground military center that was walled off after war to outfit a small portion with the necessary climatic conditions to store paintings. This wasn't for art, another museum official said. It was in case Berlin fell. It would be one of the possible structures of command for a government in exile. It sounded far-fetched, but Hitler built a number of secret underground headquarters. Perhaps Nazi Governor Schirach had hoped a special contingency bunker would restore his lost favor with Hitler. Officials at the Belvedere and Federal Monument Office maintained for years they had no idea why the bunker was built. Yet Hans Arendhammer, a highly respected post-war Belvedere director, wrote in detail of the Belvedere during wartime in his 1971 history, Das Belvedere in Wien. His book shows Hitler presiding over a 1940 reception in the Belvedere's marble hall in one of the many period photographs that are now locked out of sight somewhere. In those days, Arnhammer wrote ruefully, the Belvedere was rechristened the castle of the first Reichsmarshal by the National Socialist daily, the Volkischer Beobachter. By 1943, Arnhammer wrote, Vienna was no longer far from the combat zone. Under the pond of the upper Belvedere, a large bunker was built that Hitler was to move into in case of the transfer of the headquarters to Vienna. Of course, this did not happen. The fortified refuge was completed in 1944. The Central Air Raid Police Command post of the Vienna district moved in. There was a monitoring tower on the roof. In the park, there were floodlights and a flak battery with heavy anti-aircraft guns. The protest of the gallery's management against this exceptional threat to the Belvedere was in vain, Arnhammer wrote. It was too late. The Belvedere was a military target. Allied bombs thundered down. Prince Eugene's roof, modeled on the billowing tents of the Turks, he had conquered, caved in. Long after the war, the Austrian architect Hans Hollein wrote about the Führer headquarters in the bowels of the Belvedere, comparing the museum to a volcano with an incendiary subterranean secret. Were Austrians' paintings hidden in the old refuge of the Führer? For the Führer? Frodel had no comment. He swept past reporters and strode briskly out of the Belvedere gates, then down toward the Theresianum, where in another era, Nazis trained child cadets to shoot. 3 years after the initial query, A new administration provided a brief explanation for the subterranean secret. "Please note what the Belvedere has to say about the bunker," spokeswoman Lena Maurer wrote in a November 2009 email. "The collections of the Belvedere were sent out in 1942-43. In June of 1943, the construction of the bunker for the protection of Adolf Hitler began between the palace and the pond. From October 1944 onwards, it was used by the Central Air Raid Police Command Post for the Vienna District. On November 18, 1944, bombs of the Allied forces hit the palace and destroyed part of the western wing. On February 21, 1945, massive air raids led to severe damage to the main building. Please do not hesitate to contact me in case you need any other information." And that is the end of that chapter. And we are down to the last two chapters of the book. I will do that on the next cast, and we will be finished with this story. It's been one humdinger, hasn't it? I don't know if some of you that are listening have been here for the whole time, but this is one heck of a story. We have to really give kudos to Anne-Marie O'Connor for writing this book. I have to say, and I'll say it again probably next time, but at the end of the book, she has provided notes on every chapter of where she's gotten her information, and there's an index to the book is indexed, so you can go and find certain things or certain people and where they appear in the book. It's really quite well documented and researched. So I've enjoyed reading this book because I like historical well, it's a nonfiction book, but I think it's fictional at some level. I don't know. I'm trying to think if I had the first part of this. No, I'm missing the first part of the book. I'll have to go back and look for the next time when I read, but I'm going to look into doing a little summary at the end, maybe. Maybe there was somebody that wrote about it, because I just find that this whole era wrapped around this painting and how she wove the story together is just fascinating. So that's that. Next time you'll hear the last part of the book, two chapters. All right. Thanks for listening. Till next time.